calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And every time Rush Limbaugh hears that theme music, he ups his meds. Welcome back to the program, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour. Happy Tuesday to you. Our quote for the day: to waste, to destroy our natural resources, to skin and exhaust the land instead of using it so as to increase its usefulness, will result in undermining in the days of our children the very prosperity which we ought by right to hand down to them, amplified and developed. That from the Republican President of the United States, Theodore Roosevelt. Coming up later in today's program, David Springmeier is here as new book, Ann Coulter is a Skinny Blonde Idiot. Right now, Jeff Johnson is with us. He's a staff writer for CNS News, the conservative news site, internet news site, Cybercast News Service, cnsnews.com, their website. And, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. I had not heard the title of that book you mentioned. I look forward to reading that.
Yeah, it's really rather funny, actually. And we'll see how he does with it. It's Ann Coulter is one of the strangest phenomena in the American media circuits these days.
The word I heard used that I thought was particularly accurate was caustic.
Well, I'm amazed. Yeah, I mean, she's somebody who's basically famous for being famous. You know.
Yeah, she's in that Paris Hilton crowd.
Yeah,
in
yeah,
that regard.
And that to me is a bad sign for the culture of the United States. But that's a whole other discussion. Over at CNS News, you guys had an article. Ellison Espak wrote it. Brady campaign dismisses influence of college gun clubs, and it's about the growing trend of gun clubs on college campuses. Give us a snapshot of this.
Well, this is something that is being encouraged by a group called the Leadership Institute's Campus Leadership Program, and essentially what this is, it's a conservative group that tries to recruit conservatives on college campuses to organize and to get together and to let conservatives know that they're not alone, even though there a lot of people believe that there tend to be more liberal voices on college campuses than conservative, and they're just organizing around various issues, and the particular focus of this article is the 41 out of 738 of those conservative student groups that identify themselves as gun clubs, and how that number is increasing, and the pro-gun organizations like Gun Owners of America see that as a good thing, and the anti-gun organizations like the Brady Campaign see that as no big deal because they don't believe it's going to have any influence.
Mm-hmm. Now, what's Cybercast News Service, CNSNews.com, what's your take on this?
All we did essentially was interview Gun Owners of America and the Brady Campaign and the folks from the Leadership Institute and get their take on it. Our editor-in-chief, David Tebow, has not written on this editorially, so he doesn't have a position or hasn't stated a position that I could share with you yet. But it's interesting.
What's your position, Jeff Johnson?
They pay me to keep my position out of my writing and out of my interviews. Keeps me out of trouble. But
well, then what are you doing on this program?
It's just so much fun to talk to you, Tom.
I
come on the program. I mean,
okay, well, let me toss out my position, and
okay.
If you choose, you can go at me on it, and if not, then we'll go on to some other topic. Australia. Well, here's my take on it. It seems to me that first of all, the pro-gun bunch is by and large, you've got an industry, a very, very wealthy, relatively powerful industry that's tied in large part, very, very well tied into the Pentagon, into the Defense Department, into the whole defense budget, the military industrial complex, as it were, that sees as a new profit model or a new profit opportunity, sell more guns. And that in and of itself you could argue, hey, you know, businesses have the right to sell things. But this group has so much power that they've been effective in lobbying against things like, I mean, common sense things, like required trigger guard locks, you know, for guns. And so, number one, I see this as a essentially craven attempt by a very profitable industry to increase its profits by increasing the number of people who are buying its products. Number two, you know, I went to college. I've lived in college towns. I know what it's like on a college campus, particularly on a Friday or Saturday night, but increasingly 7 days a week. And I'm not sure that I want to see the number of drunken teenagers on a college campus who own guns increasing.
Well, last point first. Most of the, at least public colleges in the United States, require individuals who participate in gun clubs like this who live in on-campus housing to keep their firearms locked up in an armory. Usually they have a reserve, you know, the military ROTC, Reserve Officer Training Corps program. And I know that when I attended a public university in Arkansas, we had to secure any firearms that we owned in the armory there at the ROTC. So if you did choose to go out and get drunk on Friday or Saturday night, you're not going to play with your gun because it's locked up in the armory.
But you are if you live in a frat house. You are if you, assuming that it doesn't have rules against it, or in some cases, even if it does, number one. Number two, you're assuming that everybody who lives in a dorm actually follows the rules of the dorm. I'm sorry, I've lived in a dorm.
No, that ain't the case. I'm not going to be charged with that assumption. I live in a college dorm.
and number three, you've got an awful lot of people who are living in off-campus housing. I mean, you know, on-campus housing increasingly is the province of freshmen.
And you're assuming that everybody who owns a firearm is going to go out and get drunk on Friday or Saturday night, and therefore
I'm saying all it takes is one for a tragedy to happen. I mean, why should we be encouraging something like this?
All it takes is one criminal with a knife on a college campus to attack someone who doesn't have a firearm, and you've got, like we had in Washington D.C. over the weekend, you've got someone who has their throat slashed because they tried to intervene in a rape.
But if you look at the numbers, you look at the real numbers, every time a gun is used in a home, in a legally justifiable shooting, okay, which self-defense is legally justified, for every one of those, there's 22 criminal, unintentional, or suicide-related uses of firearms.
Mm-hmm. Now,
the presence of a gun in a home triples the risk of homicide. Triples the risk of homicide in that home by relatives who know
Tom,
each other.
Tom, and it increases the risk.
Well, let me just finish this last statistic.
Increases
the risk of suicide fivefold.
Every time we talk, you've got a fantastic research department. You stack up a bunch of statistics that you don't provide me with or the sources for with in advance to give me a chance to research and possibly, if those statistics are inaccurate, provide some statistics to refute them. Now, what you just cited, you talked about use of the gun in self-defense, and you talked about self-defense shootings. All of the statistics that you just cited are based on only counting something where a crime victim shoots the attacker as self-defense. I can tell you from personal experience, both as someone who is the target of a crime and someone who is a former law enforcement officer, that there are many, many, many more times that a person merely makes a potential attacker aware of the fact that they possess a firearm or displays that firearm to the attacker that the crime ends at that point. It has happened to me personally, so I know for a fact that it happens. I have taken reports from citizens that it has happened to, so I know for a fact that it happens. So it is completely inaccurate to quote statistics that only count as self-defense the shooting of the criminal with the firearm.
But are you suggesting, Jeff Johnson, that of CNSnews.com, are you suggesting that college campuses are such dangerous places that people should be sleeping with a gun under their pillow?
Well, I think sleeping with a gun under your pillow is dangerous because of the possibility of an accidental discharge.
Do I think it's a good idea?
Well, but the rhetoric is important, Tom. Do I think it's a good idea for people who choose to accept the responsibility of owning a firearm to band together to learn about the law, to study self-defense, to practice with that firearm so that if they are placed in a situation where they're forced to use it for self-defense, that they will know how to do so accurately and not endanger someone else? Yeah, I think that's a great idea.
You know, in 2003, there were 163 justifiable homicides in the United States by private citizens using handguns. 163. People killing somebody in self-defense using a gun. And I agree with you. You're pointing out, you know, a lot of times just pulling the gun is enough. But nonetheless, just to compare apples to apples, 163 justifiable homicides. That same year, 30,242 people died from firearms-related deaths. Now, that's about the number of people who died in the Korean War. It's a little more than half of the number of Americans who died in the Vietnam War. That's in 1 year in the United States. Why should we be encouraging, particularly among kids on college campuses, an increase in the use of and ownership of firearms?
Well, if you're going to look at it from that perspective, Tom, then what we need to do is disarm our police officers, because there are two statistics that you need to be aware of. First of all, civilians shoot and kill twice as many criminals as the police do, according to the National Institute of Justice, and only about 2% of those civilian shootings were mistaken, whereas the error rate for police is about 11%, five times as high.
I don't get why that.
Well, if you
the fact that 30,000 people die from firearms-related deaths has got nothing to do with police.
30,000 people died from accidents that were had with firearms, from criminal acts that were committed.
17,000 were suicides. 726 were accidents. 11,829 were murders.
So let's do something about the criminals who are committing the murders.
Yeah.
Let's do something. Yeah.
Okay. Jeff Johnson, CNSnews.com. You can read all about it there. Jeff, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, I'm deeply sorry, what's wrong with me? I put my face between a bird and Dick Cheney. Accidents will happen and I should have ducked. I'm in love. I'm all shot up. Yeah. Oh, well, my face is bloody, looking like Swiss cheese. Bird shots flying every time I sneeze. Who do you think of when you have such luck? The BP. I'm all shot up. Yeah. Well, the press just asked me what's on my mind. I've been shouting, had a heart attack and feeling fine. When I'm near the deck that I love best, I'll be wearing a bulletproof vest. Well, sorry for the trouble that my dick went through, but he can shoot me anytime that he wants to. I'm proud to say he's my vice president. I'm in love. I'm all shut.
And welcome back. I love that. What a great bumper. Oh, thank you, Louise. Welcome back to our program, 22 minutes past the hour. And also in the thank you, Louise category, boy, you got a great compliment there from Jeff Johnson. We have a serious and capable and competent, I forget the exact words he used, research department. Louise came up with the statistics about firearm facts and gun ownership here this morning. Took about 10, 15 minutes with a Google search before we went on the air. I thought you did a great job. And so thank you. Thank you for that. And in fact, I think, you know, the bigger picture here, I mean, speaking, I suppose I have an emotional dog in this race. My very best friend from junior high school and high school committed suicide with a gun. And, you know, it was a bad day for him, and he put a gun in his mouth and blew the back of his head all over the wall. And I'm telling you, it's something when you see the consequences of that use of a gun, it's something you don't easily or quickly forget. In Australia, as a result of 1996, what's referred to as the Port Arthur massacre, it happened on April 28th in 1996. This guy, a disturbed man, a fellow was, you know, beyond mentally ill. I mean, there's something seriously wrong with this guy. He went on a killing spree, killed 35 people, injured 19. And the entire country was horrified. And the next year, the Australia passed probably one of the most significant gun reforms in the history of the Western world. They placed an absolute ban on semi-automatic rifles and pump-action shotguns. Registration of all firearms and licensing of all shooters. And the idea, hey, you got to have a license to drive a car. And a car is not designed to kill things when used as directed. Guns are. So if you're going to use a gun, you have to have a license. It just makes sense. And criminal penalties for the failure to safely store guns and ammunition. You know, an absolute requirement that guns and ammunition be required. So, and then Australia allocated $320 million and said, we will buy back your guns. You got a gun you don't want? We'll buy it back. And it was massive. I mean, they bought back 643,000 guns. Now, per capita basis, that would be the equivalent of buying back 40 million guns in the United States. What's the result of this now? Of taking all of these guns out of circulation in Australia? Again, it's not illegal to own a gun in Australia. You just have to have a license and you have to, you know, legally store the thing. But they sucked out the equivalent in the United States of 40 million guns. The result of this is that homicides committed with firearms have been declining. 21% of all homicides in 1997 were done by guns, down to 16% in 2003, the last year for which we have statistics. Australia saw a 44% decline in the use of firearms and armed robberies between 93 and 2003. Suicide rates using firearms dropped 48%. And firearms-related accidental injuries in Australia are also declining. So, you know, I'm not saying that guns should be banned. I don't want to, you know, and I don't think most people are. There may be a few people out there who are saying, oh, we've got to get rid of all the guns. But, you know, no, I'm not suggesting that. What I'm suggesting is that we should take gun ownership at least as seriously as we take car ownership in the United States. And that, frankly, in my opinion, the proliferation of guns in the United States, in large part because of the hyping of the gun lobby, of the gun industry, is not serving our country well. And they're all claiming the Second Amendment. Oh, the Second Amendment says you have the right to a gun. I'm sorry, the Second Amendment came about because of Thomas Jefferson saying that there should be no standing armies when we're not at war. Jefferson felt that when we're not at war, the army should be dissolved, and that the army should come into being instantly in one day when we go into war. And how do you do that? Well, every citizen is a member of a militia, and they keep a gun in the closet safely. And when the church bells ring a particular way or the siren goes off a particular way, everybody grabs their gun. Back in those days, Jefferson's proposal was every able-bodied man between the ages of 17 and 47 grabs their gun, steps out in front of their house, and boom, the entire country is the army. And I think that's a great idea. It works for Switzerland. In fact, many argue that it's the reason why Hitler never bothered to invade Switzerland, because he knew he'd be taking on literally the entire country. What are your thoughts on gun control and gun ownership? Our number 866-404-8466. You can drop into our live chat room by going to, 440-8466. 866-440-8466. Or go to TomHartman.com and click live chat. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Come on over, come on over, come on in, come inside, baby. Won't you come on up?
And welcome back. Speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone, Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. Let me get back into this gun control discussion, and we've got quite a few calls on it. We're going to pick up in just a second. I want to take just a minute and a half, almost 2 minutes, and just share something with you. I have been saying for the better part of 2 years that Bush will, as Nixon did, Bush will use this war for political purposes, that the reason he got into the war in Iraq, what is now the occupation of Iraq, the reason he started the war in Iraq was for political purposes, he did it to get political capital, and that he will end the occupation in a politically timed fashion. He will take a good step toward ending the occupation just before the November 2006 elections, and he will end it altogether or in large part just before the 2008 elections. And here, this is a clip from a National Public Radio, an interview that was done with Zbigniew Brzezinski. Thanks to Jim Turr in Santa Fe for sending this to me. It's just about a minute, and just particularly listen to the last part of it, where Brzezinski says that he has spoken with a colleague inside the Bush administration, highly placed. That would have to mean, I mean, when somebody at the level of Brzezinski, who was the national security advisor to Jimmy Carter, says, you know, a senior administration, my guess is he's talking about Colin Powell. But it could be Richard Armitage or somebody else. But here, just listen to this.
The president, of course, has referred to Iraq as the front line in the war on terrorism. If the United States isn't there anymore, where does that front line go?
That's Scott Simon.
I honestly, and with due respect for the president, have to say that that's a totally demagogic slogan. What does it mean? Is the notion that those who are setting off explosive devices against our troops or participating in sectarian violence, then going to swarm somehow across the oceans and attack the United States? The reason they're doing that is because of what is happening in Iraq. That violence occurs because we chose to go into Iraq, and we chose with very poor planning, particularly for the post-military success phase.
So here Brzezinski calls Bush a demagogue, and demagogic discussion, and points out the reality, the fact that we're not fighting them over there to stop from fighting here. We're fighting them over there because we showed up in their backyards, and they're saying, get out of my backyard. But then the kicker, Zbigniew Brzezinski.
Once we agree on a settled date for departure, we announce it as a joint decision. And incidentally, I discussed this with a top administration official, and that person looked at me and kind of smiled and said, well, Zbig, this may surprise you, but we plan to do something along those lines, except we're going to call it victory.
Get that? Bush is going to do what Jack Murtha is asking. He's just going to do it on his timeline, a politically defined timeline, and he's going to call it victory. Amazing. Anyhow, back to the issue of gun controls. 1-866-440-8466. Should we be encouraging the ownership of guns by college students on college campuses? I've just spent enough time on college campuses. It just doesn't seem to me like a good plan. But Paul in Dallas, Texas. Hey, Paul.
Yeah, Tom, I just wanted to say that I really love your show, and I wish they had 4 hours of you on Sirius. But
well, thank
anyway,
you. We only do 3 hours a day, but thanks for the kind words.
I just have to say I was kind of – you had me worried there. I thought I was going to have to part company with you on the Second Amendment. You kind of clarified a little bit more. But with these gun clubs, I work full-time and go to school, and I would say why let the conservatives control this group of individuals? You know, if I was a member of one of these gun clubs, I would be arguing the more progressive way of thinking. Mm-hmm. The only thing I'd share in common with them would be my, you know, belief in the Second Amendment.
Like to shoot guns.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. The Democratic, I mean, young Republicans have been around since I was a little kid. You know, I'm assuming that I haven't seen a lot of young Democratic groups on campus, but I'm guessing that there are them out there. You know, why don't they, cut a deal with a local shooting range or something and go out periodically? I mean, you don't have to own a gun to go out and shoot in a shooting range. I mean, I've shot in shooting ranges when we lived in Atlanta. There was a couple of them there. In fact, I took my kids out and said, you know, try this out. This is how they work. This is what it's all about. These things are real. And, not in a negative way, just here's what's so.
I'm kind of afraid just that, you know, we have so many more important issues with our trade policies with China, issues with unions, health care, things of this nature, that I'm afraid that if Democrats become too entrenched in being, anti-gun ownership, that we're going to lose people on all these other ideals. And with these elections being so close, I say, why give it to them? Why give it to the conservatives?
I agree. I agree with you, Paul. And I think that, one of the reasons, for example, that Bernie Sanders has done so well in Vermont, which is a very rural state where, you know, not everybody owns a gun, but a lot of people own guns, is because his position has been, hey, gun control ought to be up to local communities. The rules in New York City of whether or not you can or should own a gun should, of necessity, be very different from the rules in rural Vermont or rural Wyoming. And I agree with that position. Paul, thanks a lot for the call. Bill in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Bill.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better, Bill. What's up?
You,
you seem to have guests who can really light my wick, let me tell you.
Well, I think it's important that we have these conversations because these guys are all over the media and nobody's talking back to them. So I'll put them on this program where we will talk back to them, and I think that's a healthy thing for all of us. I think it's a healthy thing for democracy.
All right. Well, first I want to give my – because he threw in that – I was a former law enforcement officer. Mm-hmm. I'm the retired detective from Chicago. I spent 28 years on the street. Mm-hmm. My reading of guns is completely different than his reading of guns. I don't know where he was a policeman or what he was doing, but, you know, I don't want him to be able to use that to enhance his credibility. But first of all...
Well, maybe he was a law enforcement officer in some little town where, you know, gun violence meant that, you know, Ralph shot his dog by accident when he was hunting last summer, you know.
Or he was a desk jockey somewhere, right, you know.
Well, who knows? I mean,
yeah,
let's,
right.
You know, he's not here to defend himself, so let's not. But
absolutely.
Your experience in Chicago, Bill, tell me your thoughts about gun ownership.
Well, first of all, and the other thing is he throws out the knife thing. I love when they throw the knife thing out. First of all, generally speaking, you can run away from a knife.
Yeah,
I mean, it's kind of hard to run away from a gun.
Yep.
You can't be carjacked with a knife because you'll roll the window up on the guy, right?
Yeah.
It's not even comparable with the lethality of the two weapons you're dealing with here.
Right.
You know, if you think you got a better chance of being surviving a gunshot rather than being stabbed, boy, I don't know what world they're living in. But you know, and the other thing about this carrying guns, you know, it just bothers me. It has bothered me for years. I remember when I was going to college and we had the gun owners and everybody should carry a gun, it'll stop crime. I've known policemen who have had their guns taken away from them because when the other guy has his gun out first, you can't outdraw him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the first thing...
Oh, you mean taken away from them in a situation where they confronted criminals?
Right, absolutely. Yeah. Or, the one guy I specifically know, he walked up on a traffic stop. He thought it was a traffic stop. They were bank robbers escaping a bank robbery.
Oh, my.
And, of course, they took his gun away from him. He was lucky he survived. But the fact is, if robbers are out there and they know people are carrying guns, the first thing they're going to do is take their gun away from them.
Or kill them.
Yeah, when they... I mean, once they have their gun pointed at you, what are you going to do with your gun?
Yeah.
You know, and so
Bill, as a former Chicago detective, 28 years in the police force there in Chicago, what do you think should be the policy of the United States with regard to guns?
Well, actually, I'm even a much stronger advocate of gun control than you are or most people are. Statistically, internationally, you can use per capita, you can use averages. The countries with strong gun control laws or almost no guns have much lower murder rates. They have much more lower violence rates as far as, you know, lethal injuries or near-mortal injuries being inflicted. I mean, it's just there. It's obvious. People just don't... I understand we have the Second Amendment, but, of course, it's all in the reading of the Second Amendment.
Yeah.
And my reading is that's for militias. That was to protect the states from a federal government standing army so that they couldn't be bothered by the federal government, you know. I mean, that was my reading.
And that was the Pennsylvania reading of it. Jefferson's original idea was actually that would be the national army in time of need. He didn't prevail, but of course,
this is an 18th century concept that doesn't deal with the idea of the higher tech and the better training. Well, even back then, if you read in military history, the people who were militias never stood up well against regular army troops, even in the 18th century.
Well, actually, I would disagree with you because the irregular militias of North America stood up to the British Army and kicked their butts.
Well, that was really though the main guys were the American
Prussians.
Regulars that they had trained in. They brought into the Continental Army.
Oh, okay. George Washington's men.
Right, George Washington's men, and they had time to train them and drill them and everything. And of course, the other thing is like the famous Battle of Yorktown. There were more French troops there than there were American troops there, and the French provided the artillery, and of course they were all professionals. My argument has always been for years, you know, you can have a neighborhood, you can have a town of 50,000 people, and they can all have guns. I'll tell you, I can march in there with an organized 500 men, and I'll have all their guns taken away from them
within a matter of a month or two.
Interesting. Because, Bill, thanks for the call. You're always very thoughtful on these topics that have to do with law and order. I appreciate your background, your experience, and your call. Bill, thanks for listening. Good talking with you. It's 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program, the pill that will help you escape the matrix. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann program.
Back to the Tom Hartmann radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. 9.5 minutes before the hour, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Matt in Sacramento, California. Hey, Matt.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out something. One, your state, Oregon.
Yeah.
The right of the individual to carry a gun is part of your state constitution. It's in your Bill of Rights. 42 states specifically mention the right to self-defense by gun.
Right.
42 out of the 50.
I understand.
The only two who don't are New York and Hawaii. That should tell you something. Now, where in the world did you get the idea that the right to keep and bear arms has nothing to do with self-defense?
Well, I didn't
it's all
done.
About your friend committing suicide. What's that got to do with defending my own life, my own property, my family, which are specifically...
Matt, I never said that...
42 state constitutions. Now answer
Matt, me. Calm down for a second here. I never said that the right to own a gun has nothing to do with self-defense, number one.
You
number
said
two,
we
what I,
have them?
No, what, no, I didn't say that. I absolutely
that
did not say that. I
you
said that,
say that.
What I said was, I'll repeat
okay,
it again.
Go ahead and back up, but go ahead.
Was that if the right to drive a car, which can be a lethal weapon, but, you know, when it's used properly, it doesn't kill things. If the right to own a car, if we as a society have decided that that should be licensed, then I would think that the right to own...
Is the government of Australia buying everybody's cars?
No, they're not. They're buying
guns.
They were
buying their guns. Get real.
And to finish my sentence, then therefore... I'm going to put you on hold here for a second, Matt, to finish my sentence. Then therefore, if the right to own a car, you have to have a license to use that car. You have to demonstrate competence. Because a car has the potential to be lethal, then a gun, which not only has the potential to be lethal, but is designed to be lethal, you should have to demonstrate some competence. I'm not saying you shouldn't be able to own a gun. I'm not saying that at all. As I said, I took my kids down to a rifle. My daughter loves to shoot Uzis. I mean, I'm not saying you shouldn't own a gun. I'm saying that there should be some sort of a licensure process in the United States.
That
now, why would you be
saying,
opposed to that?
And you know it's not what you're saying, because then the government has the right to decide who gets the license.
Well, of course, and
as soon as the
us.
Government has that right, we lose it. By the way, the cop from Chicago, he's not a cop from Idaho, because that's not how they talk in Idaho.
Yeah, okay.
They want their citizens armed because cops don't prevent crimes. They fill out reports after the crime occurs.
Okay, Matt, I got
it. Have a good life.
Thanks a lot. Chris in Bremerton, Washington. Hey, Chris.
Hey, how's it going? I agree with your point about people should have to be... It should definitely be a little bit harder to get a gun. I'm a licensed gun owner myself, and I have been for over 15 years. I've also been in a situation where I've had to defend myself before, but not with a firearm. But there should be a mandatory class when you get your license. But the part about, I agreed with the one caller that called up, said that the police should have their guns taken. That's definitely true, you know.
Wait a minute.
Every time,
are you saying that cops should not have guns?
Right, exactly. Every time they use them, it's usually always an accidental shooting. And then
well, no. Hey, Chris, every time, I strongly disagree with you on this. I would say that the majority of times when police shoot people, if you're looking at the statistics, and I don't have them in front of me, but if you're saying that the statistics are that most of the time police use guns, you know, it wasn't necessary or shouldn't have happened, you know, that may be
right.
The case. But I would say that the majority of times when police use guns, they don't necessarily discharge them.
Okay, well, maybe you should research the statistics then, because almost 98% of the people who get shot by police settle out of court, and that's why it's kind of hard to find the facts on those.
Yeah.
But, I mean,
but what about the people who don't get shot, but who put their hands up in the air and get arrested because the gun was in the cop's hand?
What about the people who get shot who don't even have a gun or a weapon and they get shot by the police?
No, I agree that that's a terrible thing, and that needs to be dealt with, and I think police agencies all over the United States are working to deal with that sort of thing. But the fact of the matter is, in England, where cops didn't have guns for a long time, they have guns now because of an increasingly armed populace.
A guard that gets out of the military can become a police officer. You can take a college education, so you actually had responsible citizens becoming officers. Now you have unresponsible people becoming police, so they can simply get away with crimes, and that's the criminal element.
Okay.
That's really taken a hold of this country more than anything else.
Yeah, Chris, I just have to take issue with it and say I went through the Georgia Police Academy. I didn't do the whole course to be a state police officer. I went through the course that they offered for private detectives, got licensed as a private detective. I was writing novels about them. It wasn't so I could become a PI, but I know a lot of people in that business. And my take on it isn't that we should necessarily require a college education, but that we should pay higher salaries. If we start, I mean, you know, why is it that the people who are most responsible for the future of our country, our teachers, and the quality of our day-to-day life, our police officers, are among the most poorly paid in our societies? That makes no sense to me at all. But that's a whole other rant here. John in Bushville, Illinois. Hey, John, we've got a little less than a minute. What's up?
Hi there, Tom. I was really your breath of fresh air, and in 7 months it's the first time I thought I could take issue with you, but hearing everybody else, I know that this is that everybody is partly right on this, and these are all so guns and then the automobile thing. I think I'd rather have less regulation on the automobile. It affects more lives every day, but
would you want a 17-year-old driving? You know, would you want a 17-year-old driving down the street who has no training on how to use a car, or would you want somebody who has gotten 5 drunk driving violations driving a car?
The overriding issue is population density. You know.
Well, there is that. Yeah.
It varies from region to region, the needs and stuff. You know, I'd rather see public humiliation, stockade, when there's wife beating or that or drunkenness.
Interesting. Bring back the stockade. Hey, John, you know, maybe you've got something there. And I don't know, maybe, you know, it's a... no, actually, I don't think so. I forget what state it was, where... repeat offenders, drunk drivers, offenders had to have a particular type of license plate or something, like look out for me, you know, sort of thing. I don't agree with that. I think they should simply lose their right to drive. 57 minutes past there. We'll be back right after the news.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the middle of the vast, radical, middle conspiracy. Take no imitations, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. We're going to get back to your calls. Apparently, a whole lot of people are really concerned about this. The board is totally slammed with calls about gun control. We will come back to the topic in a little bit. First, David Springmeier is with us. He's the author of Ann Coulter is America's Newest Village Idiot, the website beltwaybarbie.com. Hey, David.
I'm good to be with you this morning.
Great to have you. A lot of folks take Ann Coulter as if she were a joke. You know, and in a way, your book is doing the same thing. But there's a more serious element here, is there not?
Well, there is, because Ann Coulter, Bill O'Reilly, Rush Limbaugh have changed the debate in America, the political debate, from issues to personalities. And a great deal of it has overlapped into Congress. And we hear more about personalities and name-calling than we do about real substantive issues.
Give me a for example.
Well, I think that when Ann Coulter talks about talks about liberals and Democrats, and she tries to paint them all with the same broad brush. Liberals and Democrats hate America, love terrorists, love nothing better than to stick forks in the brains of the unborn. The debate becomes totally irrational. We can't talk about what we need to resolve in America when we're pointing fingers and calling names.
Yeah, not only are these things lies, but they're really the vilest kind of lies. I mean, they're not unlike the stories that were told by the Nazis in the 30s about Jews using Christian children's blood for Passover and stuff like that. I mean, it's just these absolutely bizarre. In fact, fascinating. I wrote an op-ed for Common Dreams back about 2.5-3 years ago, where the fellow who was then my producer, he went by the name Zen Pickle online, had taken a chunk of Mein Kampf, a book by Adolf Hitler, and simply replaced the word Jew with the word liberal, and replaced Germany with America. And you read it, and it reads like Ann Coulter. I mean, it's absolutely spooky. I put it up on the web, and people read it, without saying what it is. And then down at the bottom, it said, "Oh, by the way, this is from Mein Kampf." And people read through it, and then they get the, "Oh my God, Hitler wrote that?" I mean, I'm reading that kind of stuff right now in America.
That's right, and you read it in every one of Ann's columns and her books. I think it's interesting too that the National Society of Newspaper Columnists recently awarded her their Sitting Duck Award. And what they said was they awarded it for cheapening the political discourse in America, and that we award the lame duck reluctantly because we know that Ms. Coulter is desperate for any kind of attention. And the truth is that she's about selling books, and not so much about making America a better place.
Oh, selling books and getting a very, very good speaking fee when she speaks.
Exactly.
She's about making money.
That's
and
right.
She's doing very well at it, by the way.
And she is. And the reason I wrote the book is that I think that Americans need to understand exactly what she stands for and the kind of things that she does say, and perhaps will come to our senses and stop buying her books. I know that she's syndicated in 100 newspapers across America, and only one has the Shreveport newspaper has thought about discontinuing her column because of the things she said about the 9/11 widows.
Hmm. Remarkable. We're talking about David Springmeier. He's the author of Ann Coulter is a Skinny Blonde Idiot is the title of the book. BeltwayBarbie.com is the website. David, your book title it could be described as a cheap shot in and of itself. Why did you choose that?
Well, I recently was watching Mel Brooks in an interview, and what he said, someone asked him that the producers made light of Hitler and what happened in Germany, and Mel Brooks said that you cannot argue with these people, you can't debate with them because their views are so extreme, and so what you have to do is you have to make fun of them.
Yeah, uh-huh. And in fact he did.
For Hitler and Germany.
from Mel Brooks' book, the producers. I love the whole Mel Brooks. He did a marvelous job of that with the producers.
Yes, he did. Yeah.
And what you get is that these people who take themselves so seriously and manipulate the average person with that seriousness are really about another agenda. In the case of Hitler, the other agenda was power. In the case of Ann Coulter, the other agenda is making money and being famous.
Right, and Ann has followed a fairly similar formula. I watch Bill O'Reilly every once in a while. At the end of his program, he takes 30 seconds to pitch his website and his store and try and sell golf balls and T-shirts.
Mm.
So it's pretty much...
So it's an infomercial.
That's right. And what they've learned is that he who shouts the loudest sells the most books and T-shirts.
Mm-hmm. And we have become a country where that is the highest value? I mean, that's what we've come down to?
Well, it's come that way, and we see it at election time. The candidate...
Oh, hang on just a second here, David. I'm sorry.
Polls go south. They start name-calling.
Yeah, as soon as the polls go south, they start name calling. Interesting. The book, Ann Coulter is a Skinny Blonde Idiot. David Springmeier, the author. David, thanks for being with us today.
Well, I appreciate it, Tom. Good to be with you.
Good speaking with you. It's 12 minutes past the hour. Let's get back to some of these issues here. Paula in Bayonne, New Jersey on the line. Hey, Paula, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. First of all, I just want to thank you for the clip from The Producers. That is my favorite movie.
You're great. I think it's a marvelous movie. And Mel Brooks is a genius.
The original, not the musical.
Yeah.
Secondly, that I felt that caller, Matt, was very frightening.
The guy who was yelling at me for arguing in favor of gun control.
Exactly. You were
not even gun control.
A reasonable argument with him, and he just totally flew off the handle. In my world, he wouldn't be able to have a gun.
Well, I think there are some people out there, and I'm not speaking specifically of Matt, because I don't know Matt, I don't know his life, and I don't want to, you know, play amateur shrink here, even though I played one in real life at one time. But there are some people out there who are so fundamentally terrified. You know, they just live with such a level of fear and insecurity. And the media certainly plays into that, you know, constantly hyping every little thing. The fact of the matter is, for example, the crime rates have gone down pretty steadily over the last 15 years. And yet people are more and more afraid. And out of their fear, they're grasping for something that's going to make them less afraid. And having a gun makes them feel safe.
And I want to question, like, what's the population of Idaho relative to the population of just New York City? I mean, he brought up New York as one of the only two states that doesn't have a right to a gun guaranteed in the Constitution.
Yeah, and I don't know if that's true or not. I'm you know, willing to believe him that it is, but you know, whether it is or whether it isn't, the right to something doesn't mean that you can't regulate it. For example, we have the right to free speech in the United States, but that doesn't mean that you can stand up in a theater and yell fire. You'll still go to jail.
I mean, I live right outside New York City. I live in a very densely populated area, and Like, I'm happy that not everybody has guns around here. Every time it snows, and I'm looking for a parking space.
Yeah, there you go. Paula, thanks for the call and for pointing that out. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Dan, and also, it must be New Jersey Day. Dan in Westville, New Jersey. Hey, Dan.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Or is it Art Dan?
Sorry?
It's Dan. I'm sorry. Yeah,
it's
go ahead.
Dan, yeah. Sorry about that. Thanks for taking my call. Actually, I've just for the first time tuned into your show today, and I see you're addressing one of my favorite topics. I wanted to comment, actually, since I've been at home, I've heard a lot of different things I wanted to respond to, but I'll stick to the one I called about, which is the detective who made the claim that, basically, internationally, countries that have stricter gun control have lower incidence of violent crime. And I know that's a very popular thing for people to say, and people like to cite Great Britain for that principle, but it's so completely not true. That there's absolutely no correlation between countries that have gun control at their levels of violent crime. You can pick countries in every category, countries that have low violent crime and high gun ownership and low gun controls. You can pick countries that have lots of gun control and extreme amounts of violence. And there's really no correlation.
Yeah, well, I'm not making that argument, Dan. I'm just saying that, to get back to the original discussion, I don't think that we want to be encouraging college students to own guns. You know, I mean, you know, I don't want to forbid them from it. I just don't think that setting up a club and saying, hey, this is really cool, come on over here, hey, bye, but sponsored by Smith & Wesson. Yeah, I just don't think that's a good idea. And, you know, and again, not that I want to stop it, I just don't think it's a good idea. And number two, I think that, you know, if somebody's going to own a gun, they should at least be as competent at using that gun as I have to be in order to use my car.
Well, I'll see you on that. But as far as the car analogy goes, that's another analogy people like to use. Well, we license cars and we register cars and we require people to have licenses. Why can't we license and register firearms? And you know, one of the differences, of course, is that cars are much more ubiquitous. So I mean, I don't think that the people that use the car analogy would necessarily agree that gun ownership should
be. I'm not sure cars are that much more ubiquitous, Dan. I mean, there's hundreds of millions of guns in the United States, are there not?
No, I understand. What I'm saying simply is that people are licensed to drive and cars are registered, but everybody drives a car.
Yeah, Dan, I'm sorry, we're just slammed out of time here, but I got your point. 16 minutes past the hour.
is the Tom Hartman Program.
Yeah, we fuss and we fight. We can't see the light. To be happy.
Indeed, and welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you by Small Dog Electronics today. 1-800-511-MAX. 1-800-511-MACS. And give them a call and say hi. Tell them Tom Hartman sent you. You're on the Tom Hartman radio program where being progressive never felt so good. In just a second, we're going to be talking with Victoria Jones from the Talk Radio News Service. But first, Art in Vancouver, British Columbia on the line. Hey, Art.
How you doing, Tom?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Good. I have an answer for you. The answer is quantity versus quality.
And what was the question?
The question is, what's the difference between Ann Coulter and Monica Lewinsky?
Okay. Quantity versus quality. How so?
Think about it. Have you read the Vanity Fair piece about Ann Coulter?
No, I have not.
Well, perhaps some other caller can bring you up to date.
Okay.
Hey, but it really isn't that subtle.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, about your previous topic,
mm-hmm.
you were talking about Switzerland,
right?
And the arms control and so forth, and all of the gun nuts always say that the reason that the Nazis never invaded Switzerland is because each Swiss citizen has a gun and is armed and isn't afraid to use it, right?
Right, and that's probably somewhere between a third and a half of the real answer. Most of it is that Switzerland, A, was the financier of the Nazis. They were the bankers to Europe, and the Nazis didn't want that thing to go down. And B, it's basically a mountain kingdom. It's hard to get into and hard to get out of.
Oh, man, you're way ahead of me.
Or it's not a kingdom, but a mountain democracy, you know.
You're ahead of me.
Okay, all right.
Thanks.
Good.
All right. Listen to you every day.
Great. Well,
on
thanks.
My computer.
Thank you very much, Art.
Thanks,
I appreciate it. Thanks for listening
to
us there in Vancouver. Good to hear from you. Victoria Jones, our endless congressional hearings correspondent, senior correspondent from the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line from Washington, D.C. Hey, Victoria.
Well, hey, Tom. Yes, indeed. I'm not exhausted yet, but I will be, as endless congressional hearings happen this week about Guantanamo Bay detainees, what should be done with them in terms of bringing them to trial. I could give them a clue. One clue would be, let's bring them to trial.
Yeah.
That would be a start.
Let's start with going back to the Magna Carta. Let's go back to 1215. In fact, I'm curious, Victoria. I mean, you really have a bird's eye view of this stuff. You're there. You're dealing with it. You have press credentials. Yeah, all that stuff. But you're official. I mean, you can sit in the White House and ask George Bush your rude questions.
I'm sitting there right now.
Yeah, as you are wont to do. And I'm wondering if, in your opinion, which I respect tremendously, if these hearings about Guantanamo are mostly going to be for show and substance, to get sound bites and clips that will be used in ads in November, or if there's actually a real issue here that the majority of Congress is really concerned about and intends to do something about.
I actually think it's a combination of the two. I do think they intend to campaign on this. What I think they mostly want to campaign on, though, is the legislation that gets passed or doesn't get passed in September. So this will be forgotten by then. So I think more they intend to campaign on what's going to happen yet. But I do think that there are senators in particular, less House members, but senators for whom this really is an important issue and who actually care about this. So I think that these hearings matter. I mean, I think Senate Judiciary and Senate Armed Services Committee, whether they bow down ultimately to their master or not, they do have things they want to say. They do have things that they think about this issue.
I was talking with Congressman Brian Baird this morning from Washington State and on my local program here in Portland, Oregon on KPOJ, and just a few hours ago. And I pointed out that in the Supreme Court decision, in the Hamdi case, the Supreme Court pointed out that the United States is in violation of Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions. And, you know, by keeping people in Guantanamo. And that if you go back and you read the Geneva Conventions, if a nation is in violation of Common Article 3, at least, I mean, I'm not an attorney, but it seems to me that, you know, from reading it, if you're in violation of Common Article 3, you are committing a war crime, which means that the person who ordered that is a war criminal. And so I asked the congressman, you know, is George Bush going to be called a war criminal? Are there going to be, you know, is anybody going to raise this topic? He seemed to think that it was unlikely. He's a Democrat. I asked him if the Democrats would. He said, frankly, he hadn't thought that much about it. It hadn't occurred to him. I think it was probably the first time anybody had pointed it out to him. I'm wondering if this is something that's being brought up by the press.
No, I could confidently say that it hasn't been brought up yet. It's the kind of thing that might be brought up by Helen Thomas. Even I am not going to touch it.
Really? Why not?
I'd have to think very carefully about it.
You have to, well, you might want to read the decision and read Common Article 3. It's
I have brought up Common Article 3, I mean,
yeah.
Several times. I bring it up incessantly. Tony Snow is very tired of Common Article 3.
Yeah, well, but isn't it a fact that if we violate the Geneva Conventions, we are committing crimes of war?
If we knowingly did it.
Yeah.
Maybe we didn't know we were doing it.
Uh-huh.
I'm being a defense attorney for the administration.
Something you thought would never happen. Okay, Victoria Jones, our senior endless congressional hearing correspondent with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Good luck. Good talking to you. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I'm falling, I'm falling, I'm falling. Show me what it's like. The last one standing, teach me wrong, wrong, right. And I'll show you what I can be. Say it for me, say it to me. And I'll leave this life behind me. Say it if it's worth saying to me.
Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. We're going to get back to your phone calls in just a second. First, I can't let this thing slide without mentioning the issue that's going on right now with North Korea. I mean, let's just look for a moment at the, you know, who's done what, and who's been successful and who hasn't. And Kim Jong-il. Let's see. Under the administration of George Herbert Walker Bush, North Korea built 1 to 2 bombs worth of plutonium. Under the administration of Bill Clinton, the government of North Korea built 0 bombs worth of plutonium. None. Under the administration of George W. Bush, the North Koreans have built 4 to 6 nuclear weapons worth of plutonium. Now, doesn't that kind of indicate that Bush and Bush were doing something terribly screwed up and Clinton was doing something right? Suzanne Malveaux of CNN asked that question of George W. Bush. He tried to intimidate her with his, that's an interesting, you know, this is from reading Ron Susskind's first book with Paul O'Neill. This is what Bush would say to people by way of, in cabinet meetings and things, by way of telling them to shut up. It's his way of intimidating people. He tries it with Suzanne Malveaux, and she almost backs down, but she keeps going.
If I could follow up, you say diplomacy takes time.
Yes, it does.
But it was 4 years ago that you labeled North Korea a member of the Axis of Evil. And since then, it's increased its nuclear arsenal, it's abandoned 6-party talks, and now these missile
launches.
Let me
ask you, it's increased. That's an interesting statement.
See, that's an interesting statement. That's what he says in a cabinet meeting if he wants the person to just shut up and stop talking. And they do. I mean, it terrifies people who work for him. But Suzanne Malveaux doesn't allow it to terrify her.
North Korea has increased its nuclear arsenal. Can you verify that?
Well, intelligence sources say, if you'd like to dispute, that's
no,
fine.
No, I'm not disputing. I'm just curious.
Our intelligence sources say that it's increased the number of its nuclear capabilities.
It's got potential danger.
It's increased its nuclear capabilities. It's abandoned 6-party talks, and it's launched these missiles.
Yeah.
Why shouldn't Americans see the U.S. policy regarding North Korea as a failed one.
Because it takes time to get things done.
What objectives has the U.S. government achieved when it comes to North Korea, and why does the administration continue to go back to the same platform process if it's not effective in changing North Korea's behavior?
Suzanne, these problems didn't arise overnight, and they don't get solved overnight.
Yeah. But it was working under Bush, or under Clinton, rather. No plutonium was produced by North Korea under Clinton. Tony Snow would have you believe that up is down and left is right.
I understand what the Clinton administration wanted to do. They wanted to talk reason to the government in Pyongyang, and they engaged in bilateral conversations. And Bill Richardson went with flowers and chocolates, and he went with light water nuclear reactors, and he went with promises of heavy oil and a basketball signed by Michael Jordan and many other inducements for the dear leader to try to agree not to develop nuclear weapons, and it failed.
It failed, yeah, right. The Clinton strategy failed. But what happened was that the nuclear weapons program of North Korea was frozen. International inspectors were brought in. 24-hour monitoring cameras were put all over the nuclear facilities. Kim Jong-il was doing what we wanted, and that's a failure. That's a failure, according to Tony Snow and according to the Bush administration. But building 4 to 6 bombs worth of plutonium during the administration of George W. Bush and 1 to 2 bombs worth of plutonium during the administration of George Herbert Walker Bush, that's a success? If this is how these guys measure success and failure, we have a problem. Particularly if Jeb Bush wants to be the next Republican president. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Brian in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Back to New Jersey. Hey, Brian.
Hey, well, the laws in New Jersey, in order to get a gun, you actually have to apply for a gun purchasing permit. In order to do that, I mean, you just go to your local police station, you give them fingerprints, and they run it through, you know, a federal check and just make sure that you're not, I guess, crazy and or a criminal. And, I mean, I totally agree with that, because if you live in Pennsylvania, you can just go into a local sporting goods store, or Delaware, or New York, for that matter, three states surrounding me, and just pick up a shotgun or a rifle. And, I mean, that's not really necessarily a bad thing, because it's really a concealed hand weapon that I guess is the most dangerous. But I think that that everybody should have the right to have a gun, obviously, unless they're not a criminal. But you really, I agree with New Jersey's laws that, you know, you should apply for this permit, and that if you're accepted, then cool, go out and get whatever you want.
Now, here's where the other side, as it were. You can dismissively call them gun nuts. I'm reluctant to do that because I think these are serious people who have serious concerns. But I don't have a phrase to describe people who think that there should be absolutely no restrictions on gun ownership whatsoever. Pro-gun people, you know, I mean, you know, it's like, you know, in abortion, at least people have come up with names, right? In any case, what they would say is, but as soon as the government has my fingerprints and as soon as I have a license, they know where my gun is, and if they ever decide to become oppressive, they can come and take my gun away, and that's the end of you know, democracy and freedom in the United States. That's the fear that these guys have.
Then you have a gun to defend yourself if they're coming to be oppressive, don't you?
Well,
and everybody else in your neighborhood.
Yeah, in theory. And here's where their argument breaks down, Brian, and that is that if the founders had intended in the Second Amendment for us to be able to have guns in order to overthrow an oppressive government, and Jefferson was pretty clear in the Declaration of Independence that we not only have the right to do that, we have the duty to do that,
yeah,
to overthrow an oppressive government. If the founders intended to put that into the Constitution in the Second Amendment, then they wouldn't have said, you know, in order to, for purposes of a well-regulated militia, the right to own and bear arms shall not be abridged. They would have said instead, actually, the specific language, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Instead of that, they would have said the right of people, they wouldn't have mentioned militias, and they would have said the right of individuals to own cannons and warships shall not be abridged. Because if you're going to take on a state, you need state-of-the-art military hardware. I mean, the fact of the matter is that no matter how many guns you've got, if, you know, I mean, look at what happened in Waco, Texas.
Oh, yeah,
Janet Reno decided that she was going to take out David Koresh, and he had a whole mess of guns there. And, I mean, you come in with a tank, and I'm sorry, all the guns in the world aren't going to help you.
Nope.
And you try and buy a tank. I mean, you go out there and try and buy a functional tank one of these days. So, you know, the fact of the matter is if the, quote, gun nuts, the pro-gun folks, really believe that the Second Amendment is so that we can fight back against an oppressive government, then really what they should be doing and really what the NRA should be doing if they're going to continue to promulgate that myth. And I do think that we should be able to fight back against an oppressive government, by the way, but not necessarily with guns. I think that we should be able to do it in the ballot box. But if they really believe that myth, then they should be lobbying to do away with the laws that make it illegal to own shoulder-fired missiles, that make it illegal to own tanks, that make it illegal to own nuclear weapons, that make it illegal to own nuclear bombs, that make it illegal to own weapons of mass destruction, because those are the things that you're really going to need if you're going to take out a government. And you know, I'm sorry, that ain't going to happen. It ain't going to happen. Brian, I got to move along, but thanks for the call.
Thanks, Tom.
Interesting conversation. Dick in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Dick, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, Tom, I just wanted to offer a better compromise on this issue of gun control. Why not just limit it to handguns and require that everyone that purchases a handgun has to first have a concealed weapons permit?
Well, some states do.
And leave the long guns out of the equation so we don't give the Republicans an opportunity to get more ammunition to defeat, right or wrong, good ammunition, and nevertheless to defeat Democrats.
Yeah, I mean, some states do that, and in many states, in fact, you have to have a permit for a handgun, particularly a carry permit, a concealed handgun. Like when I lived in Georgia, when I went through the police academy and I got my license as a private detective, I had to still, if I wanted to carry a concealed weapon, I still had to apply for a permit to do it.
Well,
if I wanted to have a rifle, a hunting rifle, I could just go down to Walmart and buy it.
Yeah, I'm not suggesting you're getting this to carry a concealed weapon. I'm saying that any owner of a pistol or anyone who purchases a handgun has to have the requirement by law a concealed weapons permit, because that gun is concealable, and that's the gun that's used in all the crimes, not long guns.
Yeah.
And
that'll satisfy,
I think, all issues, yeah, to right or wrong. You know,
well, that's a reasonable middle ground, Dick, and I think that's what most people are looking for. Jerry in Louisville, Kentucky. Hey, Jerry. We've got about a minute before we've got to take a break. What's up?
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment on handguns in particular. I really don't understand why so many people are afraid of law-abiding citizens owning guns.
I'm not afraid of it.
No, not you in particular, but so many other people are. So many people.
I'm just suggesting that it's not, I don't think it's necessarily a healthy thing to encourage college kids to have handguns. I just don't see why, you know, somebody going to Michigan State University needs to have a handgun.
Well, when I was in college, let me give you an example. When I was in college, there was a student that was raped and murdered and burned up in her dorm room by two guys. And actually, I was in Western Kentucky, a different college that I didn't go to. But odds are,
if there had been a handgun in her room, the first thing those guys did when they kicked in the door was they would have taken the gun and made it even easier.
Well, not necessarily. Not if she's well trained and knows what she's doing.
Yeah, well, see, if she knows what she's doing and she's carrying it with her every second of every day, I mean,
that's
just not the real world. You know that.
Sure. No, not at all. But she could have had it easily accessible, maybe in her top drawer.
Well, you know, Jerry, I'd say it's the exception that makes the rule. In any case, we're out of time. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back to our program. 9.5 minutes before the hour, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Sherry in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Sherry.
Yeah, that's me, I think.
You are live and on the air.
Okay.
Well, okay, now, I don't get in trouble for this because this is like your competition, and not really your competition. Rachel Maddow this morning was talking to Michael Isikoff, and he said that Article 3 could be a problem for the administration because there are memos that are written that evidently are going to show in the Newsweek or something like that. He's going to talk about them in that.
Right.
Memos that were written that warned the administration what they were doing. And so they could be held liable for the rest of their lives or years to come by other administrations.
As war criminals. Yeah, and
as
by the way,
criminal.
Rachel is not my competition. Rachel's a good friend.
I know.
We're both syndicated by Air America Radio, and we're both carried on your radio station there, Talk 1090 in Seattle. So
that's right, yes.
You know, God bless her. I have a lot of affection respect for Rachel. So in any case, Rachel Maddow. So in any case, she had a guest on, Michael Isikoff, interesting, he's from Newsweek, isn't he? Is he not?
Right, this morning.
Yeah, who said that what is going to be coming out is that the Bush administration had internal memos in which they acknowledged before the fact that Guantanamo was a violation of the Geneva Convention.
Yes, they were warned.
Oh,
yes.
My goodness. Oh,
and,
my goodness.
And I thought that was fascinating. I loved it.
Wait, yeah, we will have to track that one down. Thank you, Sherry, for sharing that with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I appreciate it.
I love you, Tom. We all do.
Thank you, Sherry. It's very, very sweet of you. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. That was nice that she said, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was sweet.
That was really nice. I've got to tell you, if you don't buy in on a price, I am sad and a little depressed about the president. And I'll tell you why. And you quoted Theodore Roosevelt today.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of ironic. You know, here was a great Republican, right?
Yep.
And can I came across
a two-term Republican president.
Yes, I came across something that will absolutely trump everything anybody says in my judgment. Absolutely trump the Bush-Cheney tag team philosophy on the war.
Okay.
And here's what Theodore Roosevelt said. I'd just like to share it with everybody. Patriotism means to stand by the country. It does not mean to stand by the president or any public official, save exactly to the degree he himself stands by the country.
Yeah. Well said. Well said. Gary, thank you for sharing that. In fact, let me, in the same spirit, share with you Teddy Roosevelt. This is a recording made by Thomas Edison himself of Theodore Roosevelt, right around 1910, 1912, thereabouts, when he was forming the Bull Moose Party. He's speaking about conservatives.
I prefer to work with moderate, with rational conservatives, provided only that they do in good faith strive forward toward the light. But when they halt and turn their backs to the light, sit with the scorners on the seats of reaction, then I must part company with them.
Now, keep in mind, this was when the Republican Party, or at least a large faction of it, was progressive. And Teddy Roosevelt, when the conservatives turn their back on the light, I part company with them. He continues.
But the beneficiaries of privilege, the bourbon reactionaries, the short-sighted ultra-conservatives turned down to a goal.
He's talking about the short-sighted ultra-conservatives?
Then found that instead of him, they had obtained Robespierre.
He's talking about they've inherited the French Revolution for all practical purposes. They've become radicals.
They gained 20 years' freedom from all restraint and reform at the cost of the whirlwind of the Red Terror. And in their turn, the unbridled extremists of the terror induced a blind reaction. And so, with convulsion and oscillation from one extreme to another, with alternations of violent radicalism and violent bourbonism, the French people went through misery toward a shattered goal.
He's talking about the French Revolution, how the French people went through this violent, horrible time, and how the conservatives of his era are trying to put America through the same thing. And I would say this vision has been realized in George W. Bush. This is Teddy Roosevelt, Republican President of the United States.
They are ultra-conservatives. Remember that the rule of the Bourbons brought on the revolution.
In other words, yeah, the rule of the Bourbons brought on the revolution. The right wing clamping down on the rights of people brought on the French Revolution.
Friends, our task as Americans is to strive for social and industrial justice achieved through the genuine rule of the people.
Our role as Americans is to strive for justice.
In our hearts, we must have this lofty purpose. We must strive for it in all earnestness and sincerity, or our work will come to nothing. In order to succeed, we need leaders of inspired idealism, leaders to whom are granted great visions, who dream greatly and strive to make their dreams come true. Who can kindle the people with the fire from their own burning souls?
Leaders who dream great visions, who can inspire the people to make their dreams come true. That is so brilliant. Teddy Roosevelt, the Republican Roosevelt, not Franklin Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt, the Republican Roosevelt, talking about his vision of America and his concern, his fear of what would happen if the conservatives, well, as the conservatives, were continuing to whipsaw America. John Dean has a new book out, by the way, in which he talks about this very issue, about the conservatives, these new conservatives. In fact, he dedicates the book to Barry Goldwater. He's going to be on our program on Friday. And he talks about in his book, in his new John Dean's new book, about how these phony conservatives, who Barry Goldwater even wouldn't recognize, are really essentially fascist reactionaries. I mean, using my language, not his. And America really very much right now is standing at a junction point, at a turning point. And these are very, very dangerous and very important times. Perhaps the most important time for the United States in its history. Arguably outside of the Civil War, in any case. And it is so important that we become politically engaged and that we become conscious, that we wake up to what's going on around us and share that with others. We'll be back in a few minutes. 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, the third hour of our program. Thanks so much for being with us and for listening. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. Coming up, I want to get into some of the economic issues of the day. What's going on? We'll have our report on how the occupation of Iraq is going. A political perspective on how Democrats can most effectively take away from Republicans one of their most powerful frames. We'll get into that and more as we continue through this final hour of today's program. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. First, David in Augusta, Maine on the line. Hey, David, thanks for waiting for a while there.
No problem, Tom. I briefly wanted to mention to you before I get into my main topic that Lord of War, a Nicolas Cage movie about the international arms dealing, is a fascinating look, and I urge all our listeners to watch that movie sometime. You'll be really impressed by it, Tom.
I'm unfamiliar with it, so I'll keep an eye out for it.
Yeah, it's really impressive. It talks about how there are no heroes in the movie, just to give you a synopsis of it.
Yeah, sort of like John Perkins' Economic Hitman.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, sort of like that. Okay, yeah. My main thing was Ann Coulter. She's like the Janis Joplin of the right now. She says anything she wants on talk show appearances, and she also seems like she just comes in from out to a nightclub. Mm-hmm. She wears evening dresses, and I mean, this goes into my theory of that Ann Coulter is really becoming influenced under drugs. And the reason I say that is because she's now late for radio appearances. When I don't know if you caught this on
Sunday.
Yeah,
I saw it last night on Olbermann. Yeah.
On Adam Carolla?
Yeah, yeah, and then he hung up on her.
Yeah, there's an example of Ann Coulter and her. And basically, I just think that's what people really need to take into effect.
Yeah.
That the reason why she is getting more caustic and more caustic is because she really cannot keep up with the juggling of the lifestyle.
Well, it could be. I've met her. I don't claim to know her, but I've met her, and it rather concerned me. I mean, you see the very, very transparent skin that's characteristic of anorexia, and
right.
That was apparent. And you know, I just, you know, part of me, the psychotherapist part of me, worries about her, and the political part of me is worried about America as a consequence of her. So, you know, and probably talking about her at length is just giving her more press. Although I think it's reached a point where that's not possible. Like I said, like Paris Hilton, she is one of those persons who's become famous for being famous, which is a sad commentary on the nature of culture in the United States, but there it is. So,
right.
Anyhow, David, thanks for the call.
All right.
Interesting.
Welcome.
Interesting food for thought. Tom in Minneapolis, no pun intended. Tom in Minneapolis for anorexics. Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Now, first of all, I just wanted to extend my sympathies for your father.
Thank you.
Yeah. I was out of town. Regarding Teddy Roosevelt, you guys are talking about Teddy Roosevelt. I wanted to point out that this week, I think it's U.S. News World Report. It might be Newsweek. On the cover is Teddy Roosevelt.
Uh-huh.
And under that, it says Roosevelt and how he reinvented modern America. And then there's a small segment there where Rove lists the 10 lessons we learn from Teddy Roosevelt. And you know how you always say they're playing chess while we're playing checkers?
Yeah.
I've seen this before. They keep trying to mislead their ignorant followers who are ignorant of American history and trying to confuse the liberal FDR with the conservative Roosevelt and try to co-opt the New Deal successes of unions and middle class and the GI Bill and all these things. And Rove, you know what I'm saying? They take the name Roosevelt and you hear these ignorant conservatives who don't really know their history, thinking that, hey, it was a Republican that gave us the GI Bill and FDIC, you know, insurance on our bank and all this
so
stuff.
So, in other words, you're suggesting, Tom, that the reason why Karl Rove is so eager to invoke Republican Teddy Roosevelt is because he thinks that people will, many Americans will think he's talking about the Democratic Franklin Roosevelt and all of his many accomplishments. Because Teddy Roosevelt, while he spoke a good line, you know, the fact of the matter is he became president when McKinley was assassinated.
Right.
And as president, his major accomplishment, frankly, was creating the national parks in the United States. I mean, he sort of wrapped up the Spanish-American War, and that was pretty much it.
And antitrust. And
oh, that's right. He was the trust buster. He went after the big corporations.
But that's not reinventing modern America. Modern America is the New Deal. Right?
That's right. That's
and
right.
So I've seen this before with McCain talk about Roosevelt, and he doesn't use the forename, the Teddy or Franklin. They do this purposely because I've talked to other conservatives who get confused with the New Deal and Republican Roosevelt, and I know it's purposeful. I just know it because they love to play with language and history and rewrite history, right?
Yeah.
And I just wanted to point that out because I know, you know, you have the pulse of that kind of thing. You know?
Yeah,
so.
That's fascinating. You know, it hadn't occurred to me, Tom, that these guys would be so sick and twisted, so Machiavellian,
well,
that they would try to cause Americans to think that the Roosevelt, the President Roosevelt, who brought us Social Security and the New Deal, brought us out of the Great Depression, brought us unemployment insurance, brought us the right of unionization, Social Security, that Roosevelt, that they would cause, they would try to cause people to think that Roosevelt was a Republican.
Because right now, the guy, what's his name, the Jonathan Alter, he's promoting his book on Franklin Roosevelt about saving capitalism and saving democracy.
Right.
And they're trying to fight back on that to confuse their Fox drones.
Or not necessarily fight back on it, but do jujitsu, grab hold of it and move it forward.
Yes, yes. And I see that, and I've seen it before about a year ago. And I remember that, and I go, oh, these guys tried to play this game. And now I see it again. I'm walking in the supermarket, and I see Teddy's face, and I see Karl Rove doing a segment, and underneath it says, reinventing modern America. I'm going, modern? That's a New Deal, man.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
So.
Amazing. Amazing. Tom, thank you for that.
Yeah.
That's it's,
maybe
I think,
you could do an op-ed on it or something.
Yeah, I should. And here, since you brought it up, another clip from Teddy Roosevelt. This is Teddy Roosevelt about the big bosses in politics. And again, another recording from Thomas Edison, so it's a little scratchy. I'll break it up by explaining what he's saying. It's only a minute long, but still, here we go.
The big bosses of the political field, the beneficiaries of privilege, in the field of industry.
The you know, he starts out talking about the big bosses of the political field, and then he talks about the beneficiaries of industry, the wealth, the CEO class.
The men who represent that sinister alliance between crooked politics and crooked business.
The sinister alliance between crooked politics and crooked business.
Which has done more than anything else for the corruption of American life, are united as one man against the genuine rule of the people themselves. The privileged classes, the representatives of special privilege, of special interests, can always make terms with a boss
Now, here, this is, again, the Republican, Teddy Roosevelt, but the progressive. He's saying the representatives is privilege. The corporate CEOs and the politicians in their control can always make terms with the boss. And now he talks about who the bosses are.
Oh, bosses. They can make terms with the bosses who dominate the Republican Party. They can make terms with the bosses who dominate the Democratic Party. But they can't make terms with the people. They can't make terms with the men who honestly and genuinely represent the popular will.
And I would say that, you know, as much as things change, they stay the same. I mean, this is, we are right, they can't make terms with the people who genuinely represent the popular will. And so here you have the politicians. Today, we have the politicians who are the get-along, go-along politicians, the suck-up politicians, the politicians who vote for things like the Bankruptcy Act and the war in Iraq and CAFTA and NAFTA and the WTO, the politicians who go along with the agenda of big business in America, the politicians who go along with the agenda of the multinational corporations in the United States. Those politicians are the ones that are the talking heads on all the TV shows. Those politicians, be they Republican or Democratic, just like Teddy Roosevelt, the Republican Roosevelt was pointing out, you know, regardless of which side they're on, they're the ones that show up on TV. They're the ones whose op-eds get published. They're the ones who are out there. And the genuine progressives, the ones who genuinely are representing the will of the majority of the people of the United States, very rarely get the press. Paul Wellstone, more often than not, was marginalized. Dennis Kucinich, you very rarely hear his voice. Russ Feingold, he's speaking out all the time. How often do you hear him on network television? Very, very rarely. They are not willing to put him on because he's going to say things that are not in the best interest of General Electric Corporation, that are not in the best interest of Disney Corporation, that are not in the best interest of the huge multinational corporations that control the media in this country and the politicians who are in their pockets. And it's amazing. And you combine that with what Tom just shared with us about how Karl Rove is now intentionally trying to conflate Teddy and Franklin Roosevelt, who didn't even know each other. I mean, distant cousins, far distant cousins. And it's mind-boggling. It's mind-boggling. Trying to cause people to think that Franklin Roosevelt was a Republican, or that Teddy Roosevelt in some way reflected the values of the current Republican Party? Forget it. 16 minutes after the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman. But it's just another day. It's just another day. Watching girls on the street where it's all right with me. Just another day.
And welcome back, Tom Hartman with you, 21 minutes past the hour. You can drop into our live chat room by going to tomhartman.com. Click live chat. That link will take you to our live chat room. Free and available, open to the public. And also we have a new piece up on commondreams.org. You can check that out at commondreams.org or go to tomhartman.com and click articles on democracy. Our telephone number, by the way, 1-866-440-8466 all across the United States. Let's take a look at what's going on with the occupation of Iraq.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lives in the balance. There are people on the fire. There are children at the cannon. And there is blood on the rise.
Deadline Baghdad, this all from Reuters in the last 24 hours. Gunmen opened fire at a minibus, killing 10 people and wounding one in a southern Sunni district in Baghdad. In El Sirkat, 9 Iraqi soldiers were killed and 4 wounded on Monday when gunmen attacked them in El Sirkut, about 300 kilometers north of Baghdad. A civilian was also wounded in the attack. Dateline Baghdad, a suicide bomber blew himself up outside Baghdad's heavily fortified Green Zone government compound on Tuesday, killing 5 people and wounding 10, police said. And Kirkuk, gunman killed an engineer working for the North Oil Company along with his driver while he was heading to work in the northern oil city of Kirkuk. And finally, Baghdad, gunman kidnapped Wasim al-Awadi, an Iraqi consultant in Iran, from his house in Baghdad's southwestern Amil district, police and interior ministry sources said. Meanwhile, Iraq has notified the United States that they will ask the United Nations to end immunity from local law for U.S. troops. The U.S. military has named five soldiers charged in a rape-murder case that has outraged Iraqis. In an interview, this from a Reuters article by Miriam Corny, K-A-R-O-U-N-Y. She says, in an interview a week after Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki demanded a review of foreign troops' immunity, Human Rights Minister Wigdan Michael said work on it was now underway and a request could be ready by next month to go to the United Nations, to go to the United Nations Security Council, under whose mandate U.S.-led forces operate in Iraq. This is getting truly spooky. Analysts say it's improbable that the United States would ever make its troops answerable to Iraq's chaotic judicial system. In other words, we're there, we're in their country, we're saying, yes, it's a real government. They have an actual government. There's a real government there. But we're not going to let them have a court system. We're not going to let them try our guys there. After all, they're our guys. Not going to be able to try our guys. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Dave in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I wonder if I might take a bunch of loose thoughts and put them together into one cohesive one, get your comments, and possibly have you ask your guest John Dean later this week about the same thing. Something I took from your show yesterday, you talked about the during times of stress that the primitive brain develops more than the cognitive side.
That's right. And cortisol is the hormone that mediates that, yeah.
I found that fascinating, and it stuck in my brain right into the interview with John Dean I watched last night,
mm-hmm.
where he talked about something called the authoritarian personality.
Right.
And the follower.
Yes.
And the blind follower who blindly looks toward a leader. And I was wondering, on a generational perspective, I tend to notice this, particularly in the GI generation, what's sometimes called the silent generation as well that followed them. I find this blind following of a leader.
And well, when this kind of brain research was first being explored in the 60s and 70s, there were a lot of folks who were looking back and some looking forward. Hannah Arendt, for example, who were suggesting that, for example, the generation of Germany in the 1930s was willing to blindly follow the authoritarian leader Hitler because they were the children of pregnancies that occurred during the 19-teens, during World War I, which was a time of great stress for Germany.
And I was thinking exactly the same lines here in the U.S. with World War I. Also, you said it follows through to the developmental years, the Depression, and mm-hmm. then World War II.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if that tended to produce a lot of these authoritarian personalities.
Or people who are followers of authoritarian personalities. You know, as far as I know, the association between forebrain and hindbrain development and authoritarian personality following and or leading type behaviors has not been made. Although I'm not an expert on the whole issue, and John Dean reports on it. I don't think he's an expert on it either. But it's a good one to bring up and an interesting topic.
I just kind of connected the two thoughts as I did a little research on that authoritarian person. You know, Googled it yesterday after watching John Dean, and your thoughts on the brain development just kept ringing.
Well, yeah, and when I was writing it, The Edison Gene, which is the book that I wrote that talks, that it has, you know, two chapters devoted to this, there's also folks who are suggesting that one of the reasons why the generation that stood up, the children who stood up in the 60s and 70s, teenagers, young people, stood up and challenged authority, was because they were the products of women who were pregnant in the late 40s and early 50s when there was little stress, when there was very little stress. And so they had a lot of forebrain development, little hindbrain development. They were very thoughtful. They weren't so violent, which is why they weren't, you know, violent demonstrations. And, you know, it's interesting, the cycles of the whole thing. Dave, thanks for the call. I got to move along. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
You know the world be rocking to it, to it. So do it, do it, do it. Bounce with it, rock with it, lean with it, rock with it, tap with it. All my fellas, lift your hats with it. Do it, do it, do it, do it. You know the world be rocking.
Yes, indeed. Get out there and get active, my friends. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where despair is not an option. And, some interesting news on the political front. Paul Hackett has now come out and officially endorsed Congressman Sherrod Brown, who's running against Mike DeWine, the Republican in Ohio. Mike DeWine, one of the bigger cheerleaders for the Bush administration. And Paul Hackett's endorsement of Sherrod Brown hopefully will be... It will help tremendously. He says, I want to help Sherrod because I want to make our country better, make Ohio better. We need quality leadership like Sherrod Brown, someone who will stand up for Ohio families and Ohio veterans, and he has done that. That's Paul Hackett endorsing his former competitor, shall we say. And in the state of Washington, Senator Maria Cantwell's former primary challenger, Mark Wilson, who's actually been on this program. Maria Cantwell's been on the program as well. But Mark Wilson has also dropped out of the primary race and said that not only is he going to work with her, but he's work for her. Not only is he going to endorse her, but he's actually going to work with her campaign. He says, there are differences that still exist with me and some positions taken by Senator Cantwell, said the former Marine. That's Mark Wilson. He says, what has changed is my strategy. It's better to work for change from within and to have a voice at the table. This is not a concession. My conviction is that supporting Senator Cantwell is the surest way to winning for us all. And I want to salute Mark Wilson and salute Paul Hackett for getting behind the Sherrod Brown and Maria Cantwell. As I said yesterday, Maria Cantwell and I disagree on a lot of issues, but she's a heck of a lot better than any Republican that is going to be running for the United States Senate from the state of Washington. And what we need to be doing is working with Maria Cantwell to try and educate her about the issues and try and let her know our opinions on the issues so that she can become a more progressive and a more appropriate member of the United States Senate representing the Democratic Party in some areas. And in a lot of areas, she's doing a great job. And like I said, God bless her. If I lived in Washington State, I would certainly vote for her. And so I think that's just marvelous. Joe Lieberman, of course, is a whole other story. Joe Lieberman actually is going into a primary, into a contested primary. And in that primary, in that contested primary, he has now said today he officially has filed. I guess it's all final now and official and all that. That Joe Lieberman is going to run as an independent. He's qualified for the ballot as an independent in Connecticut, in the event he loses the Democratic primary, and that's pathetic. I mean, that's just plain old flat out pathetic. It's wrong. It's pathetic. You if you're going to play the partisan political game. I mean, I can see Ross Perot said, I'm not going to play partisan politics. I'll be an independent. I respect that. I disagree with it, but I respect it. He actually became partisan, you could argue, creating his own party. But, you get the point. But if you say, hey, I'm going to be a part of the Democratic Party or I'm going to be part of the Republican Party, then you do it. You stay with it. Or if the time comes that you don't think that, the party reflects your values, you do like Jim Jeffords did of Vermont and you say, I'm out of the party. And I'm an independent now. And, I lived in Vermont when that happened, when Jim Jeffords left the party. And all over the state, you couldn't drive anywhere in the state without seeing bumper stickers that said, thanks, Jim. I remember, my favorite bookstore, Bear Pond Books in Montpelier, Vermont. They had a big stack of them for sale on the counter there. And as I recall, they were really cheap. These thanks, Jim bumper stickers. Everybody had one of these things. Well, not everybody. A lot of people had these things. Because he said, I can't be a Republican anymore, so I'll just be an independent. Well, if Joe Lieberman can't be a Democrat anymore, he should get out of the Democratic Party. He shouldn't try and have it both ways. It's just wrong. It's not how things are done in the United States. It is just wrong. So that said, that brings us to our activism alert for the day.
May take a week and may take longer. Gonna win, yeah, we're taking over. Come on!
Yeah, we got the numbers, my friends. Make some public noise. I wrote a piece yesterday that's out on Buzzsplash about why are the Democrats
Why are the Republicans wiretapping Democrats? Why is Bush spying on Democrats? Why is he looking at the phone records of Democrats? Why is he looking at the bank records of Democrats? Why is he looking at the health records of Democrats? And I got an email from Lenny. Don't have a city here. Oh, in Minnesota. Lenny in Minnesota, he says, just wanted you to see my response after reading your Common Dreams article reclaiming the issues. And he sent this thing to his senator, Mark Dayton. He says, please read the article pasted below. He says, after reading that article, would you please make some public noise along the lines suggested and start yelling, I want to know why Bush, Gonzalez, and Negroponte are spying on Democrats. So congratulations, Leonard Major, for getting out there and getting active and getting activist and talking to your senator, your Democratic senator, and encouraging your Democratic senator to start demanding in the media of the Republicans, why are you guys spying on Democrats? Because they are. I'm telling you, they are. They've been busted for it. In Orrin Hatch's office, one of the senior guys in his office hacked into the computers of Teddy Kennedy and of Dick Durbin and got the information, their correspondence back when they were planning how to counter the Bush right-wing judicial nominees, published 15 of these things in the Wall Street Journal and took down the Democratic effort. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. Why would Bush refuse to go to Congress and refuse to go to judges, to the judiciary branch to get subpoenas? Why would he refuse to have any oversight over his spying on Americans? If you look at Richard Nixon, you get the answer. It's very simple. In the past, when Republicans have gone around the system, they've done it because they're spying on their political opponents. That's what this is all about. And it's time for us to speak up. Contact your member of Congress, particularly your Democratic members of Congress, and demand that they start demanding, why are the Republicans spying on the Democrats? 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. JR in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, JR, what's up?
How you doing, Tom? I've got two quick things. Number one is the gun issue. I think that most good old boys have a bigger issue with having to get permission from Big Brother, and on top of that, being extorted for the cost of the licensing to own a gun that they already have in their homes.
But they don't mind. But they don't mind Big Brother telling them they have to have a license to drive their car.
Well, I think they have an issue with that as well, but they don't have a choice.
I see.
I think, you know, I mean, if you look at the way they grew up, if you, like, for instance, like my uncle, he was a Vietnam veteran war soldier, and he's always told me, you have never experienced freedom. When I was a kid, I could drive my old man's truck into town at 12 years old, pick up supply, pick up a case of beer and some cigarettes for him and bring him back home. And there wasn't an issue. I didn't have insurance. I didn't have seatbelts. I didn't have a license. But times have changed, obviously, and that's not going to be practical. But at the same time, people that grew up in that type of an atmosphere have seen little by little that the simplicity of their life become way more, you know, technical.
Yeah, well, I would say, first off, if he's my age, if he's in his 50s or even older, if he's in his 60s, that didn't happen in his lifetime.
he lived in the outskirts in the middle of Colorado, so there wasn't a whole lot.
Then he was simply violating the law, and nobody was doing anything about it. That doesn't mean freedom. And freedom has to be, in order to be free, you know, as Franklin Roosevelt said, necessitous men are not free men. People who are hungry are not free. People who live in fear are not free. And if you're living in fear that some 12-year-old is going to come barreling down the street with a 300-horsepower car, you're not free.
Well, yeah, I understand that, and that's how things have changed. And obviously, you know, with change, you know, the necessity for you know, more foresight into what you do is necessary. But at the same time, I think that people really have a big issue with feeling as if, you know, their rights are being taken from them, and then at the same time, they have to pay the government, you know, to have something that they've always had their whole lives.
Yeah.
I think that's a big issue for them.
Yeah, I understand that, and I think it's an emotional response to a somewhat irrational emotional response. But what I don't get is why, if these guys are so gung-ho about freedom, why aren't they saying, hey, why do the big government Republicans want to come into my bedroom and tell me who I can have sex with? Among consenting as adults. Why do the big government Republicans want to tell my wife that if she gets an abortion, she's going to go to jail and so's her doctor? Why do the big government Republicans want to tell my kids who they can marry and who they can't? Why do the big government Republicans, I mean, you know, the list just goes on and on, you know. Why do the big government Republicans want to tell me what intoxicant I can take in the privacy of my own home? I mean, where are these guys who say that they love freedom when it comes to the big government Republicans trying to shove down our throats their vision of how America should be?
I think that's a great question. I think it goes hand in hand with why do real country folks turn on the Dixie Chicks who were born and bred in the country for a Connecticut Yankee?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I don't think most of these guys realize that George W. Bush was born in Connecticut. I mean, I was amazed. You know, Larry King did that whole, you know, softball interview with him on his birthday. I was amazed. No, and he even mentioned Connecticut. You know, he asked him what he thought about Joe Lieberman. And if I'd been Larry King, I would have said, hey, Mr. Bush, you were born in Connecticut. You know, you're a Connecticuter. You were raised in Massachusetts, of course, in Andover Prep School, and went to college in Massachusetts at Harvard. But you know, went through all your elementary school in Massachusetts. But you were born in Connecticut. What do you think of the Connecticut race? But you know, Larry King took a pass on that one.
Yeah, that's funny. You know, I'm from Portland. You know, I was born there, and we've got, you know, our local neighborhood of locals. You know, that have lived there most of their lives, and we have a loyalty to one another, and to me it just is ironic that that people would turn on their own for an outsider, you know, that's never worked a hard day in their entire life, you know what I mean? And this,
yeah, and every business Bush ever
called themselves country boys or country girls. You
yeah,
know what
and
mean?
every business Bush ever started failed. It's amazing. JR, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. Got to move along here. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Where tuning in is as easy as getting a White House press pass. If you're a gay hooker named Jeff Gannon,
we can handle.
They reduced our interest, so over time, we saved thousands.
If your debt has you down, call Trinity.
We did. Now we're debt-free for keeps.
Trinity.
Call the experts at Trinity for your free debt analysis at 800-936-7649. That's 800-936-7649. Call now, 800-936-7649.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
If I had one prayer to pull out thin air, everyone, everywhere would be happy. Yeah, we hand out.
Ah, yes, happiness, that word that Thomas Jefferson slipped into the Declaration of Independence, the first founding document of any nation in the history of the world to have the word happiness in it. You're right here in the United States of America. Tom Hartman here. Talk radio for the rest of us. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Karen in Sacramento, California, KSAC. Hey, Karen, what's up?
Hey, I'm a brand new listener. I really love your show.
Well, thank you.
I really need the support here.
And thank you for listening to Talk City. I don't know the frequency there. Talk City KSAC in Sacramento, right?
Yeah. And you wouldn't believe this. Another caller about 20 minutes ago called about the misinformation campaign between Teddy and Franklin Roosevelt.
Right.
Just not even 2 months ago, Paul Harvey ran that as a story. It happened truly in history. That's how Franklin actually won his campaign. That was his campaign strategy then.
You mean Franklin Roosevelt ran in 1932 in part by causing people to think that he was Teddy?
Teddy, yes.
But in 1932, people were still alive and had a memory. I mean, that was of Teddy. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt was politically active into the, well, I don't know when he died, but he was certainly politically active into the 1920s. So how could Franklin Roosevelt you know, cause people to think that he was Teddy Roosevelt? I don't
good, good point, unless Paul Harvey's in on it, too.
Well, Paul Harvey's an outspoken, unabashed right-winger and always has been.
Well, gosh, maybe they've already started the campaign with him. But I just, I was like, I'm right with you. How could people of that generation have confused that?
That would be like somebody today confusing, you know, Teddy Kennedy with Jack Kennedy. Actually, it'd be a little more distant than that, but not much more distant. I mean, there was only 30 years, 20 years, not even 20 years that separated the two of them in terms of their political activities.
I teach at a university, at a business school, and a girl there didn't even know who Ken Lay was, so I wouldn't put it past the general American public.
Well, there you go. Yeah, the old P.T. Barnum, nobody ever failed to get rich underestimating the intelligence.
It's tragic. I just wanted to say I enjoy your show, and I wanted to let you know that so you could research that and get to the bottom of it.
Interesting. Well, thank you very much, Karen, and thank you for the call.
Okay.
And thanks for listening. It's great to hear from you. That's fascinating. Paul Harvey, of all things. Casey in Seattle, Washington, listening on Talk 1090. Hey, Casey, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Always a pleasure to speak with you.
Well, thank you for calling.
I know, and I don't even have, like, this big eloquent point or anything, but I just was calling to say that it absolutely floors me that people would be so opposed to getting a license for owning a gun.
Yeah, it's me too.
I can't, like, there's no way to understand it. And that guy that called in, I mean, not to talk, you know, bad about him or anything, but it just trips me out how people, I don't understand why they're so angry.
As I said, there are many people in America, and John Dean estimates it's probably 20, 30 million people, which would be, you know, in the neighborhood of 10% of Americans, probably 15% of adult Americans, who are living in a state of almost constant fear. And the media does everything it can to promote that, you know, to be afraid, because it sells. It draws eyeballs. It's profitable. And the politicians, particularly the right-wing politicians, do everything they can to promote that. And occasionally you get a statesman or a stateswoman who comes along and says, like Franklin Roosevelt did, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. But very rarely do people speak up and hold out positive visions. I would say that the last president of the United States who was really good at articulating positive visions of the United States was Jack Kennedy. You could argue that Ronald Reagan did. The problem is that the positive visions of America that he held were actually destructive positive visions. I mean, he used positive rhetoric to promote visions that were destructive.
Well, the whole time I kept saying to, like, the radio, I yell at the radio sometimes, and I kept saying, like, he never said that. Like, you never said for people not to own guns. In fact, you know, went into about how you had your daughter go down, you know, so you could teach that to them so they could see that it was real.
Her favorite gun was the Uzi.
I'm really happy that guy has a bunch of, you know, weapons at his home. Super.
I think the challenge we have, Casey, is dealing with that fear. The point that Michael Moore makes.
I love that documentary.
Yeah, Bowling for Columbine.
I love it.
Is that in Canada, on a per capita basis, there are more guns per person in Canada than there are in the United States, and yet they have 1/1,000,000th or some incredible low fraction. I mean, it's not that. It's like 1,000.
Yeah, it was
of the murder rate
laid out.
Yeah, it really is. Casey,
I've
got to move
along.
Thanks for the call. It's great to hear from you.
I appreciate it.
Bye. Barbara in Benningham, Washington. Hey, Barbara, we have 1 minute before we have to wrap up the show. What's up?
Did you have any idea, Tom, when the 50 states decided not to go with a standardized structure for voting?
Yes, when the Constitution was written in 1787.
Where is it?
It's in the Constitution. It's actually missing from the Constitution, and very intentionally. The founders and framers wanted to keep as much as possible power at the local level, at the level of the state. And in most states chose in their constitutions not to define the powers and privileges of voting, although some did. You had some states that had poll taxes or had very restrictive things. But, you know, in the 1790s, you had some states where African Americans could vote. You had some states where women could vote. You had some states where they couldn't vote.
In favor of a standardized structure?
I'm really ambivalent about it, Barbara. I think that, you know, there are some standards. We do have some standards. For example, the Voting Rights Act of 1967 says that you can't discriminate based on race, for example. I mean, there are some standards that I think we have to have, but I'm concerned that if we had a national standard, that Diebold would come in and corrupt it. So, you know, I'm kind of with Jefferson on this, that we should,
Thank you.
You're welcome. We should, as much as possible, leave this up to local folks. Coming up on the next time.